105 Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Winter Comfort, John's Story. I'm Neil Whiteside, and I've worked here at Cambridge 105 Radio since 2011, and in that time we've covered countless stories of people who've encountered rough sleeping, homelessness in the city of Cambridge, be it long-term or short-term, and we've looked at all the different organisations that help to get those people back on track and get their lives back in order. One of those organisations is Winter Comfort, and I've asked everybody into the studio today because we've got a very different story for you. I'm joined in the studio by Melody Brooker. Melody is the fundraising and communications manager for Winter Comfort, by Alison Nolan, who's a senior women's project worker at Winter Comfort, and by John. And John, we'll start with you, if I may, because yours is a very different story to the average one. Whenever we hear stories of rough sleeping and homelessness, quite often there's some sort of dependency on alcohol, or there's mental health issues or things. Something leads people to that path. But that wasn't the story for you, was it?
No, not at all. I mean, I had only moved to Cambridge back in February of this year. And when I first moved here, I felt like I'd come to this great, vibrant city where it was full of opportunity, and I'd found a home around fellow, like, well-educated people, chemists like myself. But unfortunately, a failed relationship very swiftly led to the decline in my life and left me homeless and sleeping rough on the streets.
And there you are instantly. You said it yourself. Your qualifications. You're a chemist. So you presumably did the whole education system. You've got a great pack of degrees behind you.
So I studied up in the University of Edinburgh. So I'd always been very well educated. I'd always pushed myself to basically into continual professional development just to better myself and continue to learn. So it wasn't through the fault of lack of education or any form of dependency. There was no alcohol or drug dependency that led to my situation. It was literally just down to unfortunate twist of circumstances that was the end of my relationship.
And this, I think, is why I've got you in here today, because the story you're about to tell, whilst obviously it's your story, there are parallels with so many people across the city in South Cambridgeshire. So what happened?
Yeah, so when I first moved here, I found a job very, very quickly. I was working for a startup business, and things just very much fell in place. Everything was going extremely well, probably more than even my personal ambitions had ever sort of alluded to. And then I fell head over heels for a girl, and that relationship was a bit of an emotional roller coaster, and it got to the point where it was just quite simply it was unhealthy. Mm. And I thought I made the well-informed and mature decision to take a step away from that. And I decided to put myself in a hotel just for a couple of days, or maybe even a couple of weeks, just whilst I was looking for accommodation. Unfortunately, I couldn't take time off work, and that stay in the hotel then turned into a couple of months. But it also meant that although I was on a good wage at the time, I very, very swiftly spent my savings, and I was struggling to make it from paycheck to paycheck. It was also during the school holidays, so the prices of the hotels were ranging anything from £80 to £120 per night. So I very, very, very quickly lost everything that I had and everything I had saved. Unfortunately, I couldn't cope anymore, and I couldn't keep up with the payments. I was trying desperately to try and get together the rent and deposit, but I'd probably have around 5 to 6 days of being able to stay in the hotel at the beginning of the month before I just quite simply didn't have enough to cover the rent and deposit anymore. And then because of that, I eventually couldn't afford it anymore, and I became sleeping rough and homeless. Unfortunately, that then had a quite severe knock-on effect that led to me losing my job because I couldn't sustain the work anymore.
Did you not get any support from your employers, or did you try talking to them, or is it just something? I mean, I'm just trying to get around how you dealt with a situation, and what was it? Was it something that you tried to ask, or you didn't feel you could ask?
So initially, I didn't feel I could ask. I felt that because of obviously my education and my profession at the time, I was a little bit too embarrassed to approach them and ask for support. Plus, with it being such a small startup company, I didn't want to show any vulnerability. Especially because the role I was in at the time was somewhat known to have a high turnover rate. So I was just a little bit concerned that maybe that would reflect poorly on my image and it would almost lead to me losing my job regardless. eventually I felt desperate enough that I did approach HR, and they were willing to give me advance on my pay. But again, that advance gave me just an extra couple of days in the hotel before I was back at square one, because obviously the extortionate rental rates at the moment in Cambridge, if you look at an average room, it's anything from £700 to £900 per room in a house share. Now, when you take into account you have to have a first month's deposit on top, all of a sudden you're looking at anything from £1,400 to £1,800, and that's probably more than most people make per month on average. So in order to accommodate for that, it's more or less, it's a massive uphill battle, and it's insurmountable.
And when you were doing this, when you were seeing that, you know, as you say, living sort of those first few days on the paycheck, what about things like credit cards? Were you maxing out on that, or were you thinking, really can't do this? Were you trying to watch every penny?
See, that's where it was unfortunately, it's kind of almost as if my own success had been sort of my own downfall. I was actually living abroad for a short period. I wanted to work and travel, so I'd moved around Europe and worked in several different locations. Now, because I'd been out of the UK for so long and had so many different addresses, I was unfortunately unable to acquire any form of credit. So as I'd only been back in the UK for a short period, and as I'd only been employed in the UK for a short period, and obviously it was a short-term employment, credit companies wouldn't allow me to borrow.
Okay, so when you're faced with, well, I can't really afford to stay here beyond the end of the week, what other steps did you try and take? Did you try and contact any other organisations? Did you see if there was any other ways you could get funded? What help was out there, and what was presented to you?
So unfortunately, because I'd not been in the, well, obviously in these circumstances before, initially I didn't know who to reach out to. It was only upon obviously doing some research and finding out some of the help that is available, I reached out to SouthCams, South Cambridge County Council, and they advised me that they would be able to offer me support in terms of giving me an interest-free loan, which would cover the initial deposit and the first month's rent, which I thought was great. Unfortunately, we couldn't find somewhere for me to move into fast enough. And because we couldn't find somewhere for me to move into fast enough, and then I got to the point where I was having to sleep rough, I eventually lost my job. And because I'd lost my job, that was no longer an option, because the interest-free loan, I needed to have proof of income for them to be able to give me that loan in the first place.
My goodness. Okay, so now talk us through that crunch moment. I can't imagine what that must be like for you to then suddenly have to go, I'm going to be out on the streets tonight. Talk us through that time.
Yeah, so it wasn't so much a black and white like cutoff where there was a slightly, there was more of a sort of like elongated transition where I came to the reality that if I wasn't paying for a hotel that night, it would give me an extra couple of days to find accommodation long term. So I would stay in work as late as possible. I'd always been quite hardworking, so people didn't really second guess the fact that I was staying beyond my 4 p.m. alleged finish time. So often I'd stay until around 10 p.m. up to midnight, because I had keys for the property. So once myself and, well, once the other members of staff had all left, I'd just carry on doing work. Little were they aware of at the time, it was literally just so I had somewhere warm to stay. It was great in terms of productivity.
Yes.
But I think realistically, in hindsight, it was also trying to distract myself from the problem at hand. Just because knowing that once I closed that door behind me, I didn't have somewhere to sleep. So some nights I would finish work at midnight and I'd walk around the city until maybe 4 a.m. and I'd go back to work without sleep. Just because I knew that lack of sleep gave me that little bit of extra leniency and a bit of extra time to try and find somewhere long term to live. Unfortunately, once that got to the point that I lost my job, that's when the real fear hit, the real panic. Gratefully, I did receive a small payment, obviously, once I was let go, just in lieu of notice. So that was able to help sort of like subsidize myself for a little while. But knowing that I had no job, no income, knowing that as soon as that money ran out, I wouldn't be able to feed or support myself at all anymore, that was the biggest panic. And that was when I realized that it wasn't just me walking around the city for 4 hours trying to stay awake and keep the blood circulating and stay semi-warm. That's when I knew that I, at that point, had absolutely nowhere to go and no one to turn to.
So what did you do?
Initially, I was slightly dependent on some of the people around me. Unfortunately, it did have a massive negative effect on some of my personal relationships. Mm. Just because I think fundamentally I'd began to lose sight of who I am.
Yeah.
I couldn't really identify myself anymore, because when people first met me, they'd say, "Oh, who are you?" My natural instinct is to be, "Well, I'm a chemist. This is my background. I've traveled. I've done this." Whereas I couldn't bring myself to talk about those things anymore, because although that person was still me, I couldn't feel almost as if I was comfortable talking about those things, because I was in such a bad place. I felt like I couldn't really present myself as a person very well. So I did reach out to a couple of friends, and although they were blissfully aware of my circumstances at the time, they would occasionally allow me to sleep on the sofa, or I'd be able to fall asleep somewhere, but they weren't aware of the circumstances. And that's where it was detrimental to those friendships, because once they knew the truth, I think they were so flabbergasted that I was in that circumstance in the first place, but I think they were more disappointed and hurt that I didn't reach out to them and tell them the truth sooner.
Right.
Which I think was one thing that I've taken very much to heart, especially from those close personal friendships, is you really can never underestimate, I think we all underestimate the generosity of the people around us that truly care about us. And I think having known that sooner, I would have told them the truth. And I think if anybody ever finds themselves in that same circumstance where they are struggling, don't be too stubborn. Don't try and be too self-proud, because as much as you feel like you're ashamed and you're stuck, having that little bit of support and knowing that someone's there and understands what you're going through, that is something that honestly, like, no amount of money, no roof over your head can buy. Just knowing that those people are there and they understand and they don't judge you for that.
Mm. Indeed. So that soured those relationships. So that, as you say, that becomes less of an option for you. So at what point did you decide, well, I'm going to have to get help from some of these organisations that are out there? There must be somebody who can offer me some laundry facilities, give me a shower, give me a hot meal.
Yeah, I mean, initially I reached out to some of the available facilities that are offered in and around Cambridge. So I reached out to initially Streetwise. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, they couldn't get to me soon enough. I did reach out to the emergency out of contact, the out of hours contact at the Cambridge Homelessness through the council. Mm-hmm. And basically the only advice that they could give me, because I was physically fit and abled, and in their eyes, because of my education and background, they didn't see me as someone that fully needed support. I think, unfortunately, the way that the system works at the moment, you have to steep so low into a certain level of depravity before people are truly willing to help you. I don't think there's any support systems in place at a certain level to support people from falling. You have to hit the absolute rock bottom of sleeping rough before anybody will give you a helping hand. Having said that, I think one group that I was eventually introduced to after being passed from person to person was at Winter Comfort. So Winter Comfort is, well, it was basically my home. It was somewhere I could go for a few hours a day. It was somewhere they offered me food that I didn't have to pay for. I was given a huge, massive amount of support, and they are probably, well, fundamentally, I do owe them my life, because at a time where I felt like I was completely lost and alone, they gave me a sense of home again. But not only that, they were so professional, but so caring, as if they were friends that I'd known for a lifetime. And I just can't thank them enough for everything that they've done for me.
Oh, my goodness. And it's that whole fact that this assumption that you have to hit rock bottom before somebody will help you. Because actually, you know, you're a bright, intelligent man. You're a very capable man. Surely you should be getting help at the time when you're still able to focus. You don't want to knock you right down to the point where you're kind of losing touch with who you are before we help. That's a horrible thought. Let's turn our attention then to Melody Brooker at Winter Comfort. And Melody, this must be obviously John's story is kind of different to a lot of the stories that you hear. He's very aware of how he got there. So many people aren't aware of how they got there in some way. But these people turning up at the door, people getting in touch, you see day in, day out, week in, week out.
We do. And as you say, John's story is quite different because he has fortunately not fallen into the path of dependency on different substances that many people sadly find themselves in. And many people present with quite difficult mental health challenges and underpinning trauma that's led to their circumstances. So whilst John's story is absolutely appalling, thankfully he was able to access support before he was drawn into any, not that you necessarily would have been, John, but there wasn't the point at which he crossed over into getting involved with some of those behaviour patterns that sadly make your recovery even harder. But absolutely, you know, at the moment we see people from all different walks of life, and it may be people that are, you know, relationship breakdown. It may be people that have been in prison for a while and are coming out with absolutely nowhere to go. And it may just be people that are struggling with the cost of living crisis and really finding it difficult to maintain their tenancies. Lots of different people. Every story is different.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to pick up as well on what Melody was saying there about you didn't fall into that, into those dependencies. What sort of interaction did you have with other people who were rough sleeping and homeless on the streets? Did you come across? There's a community out there. Is there? And did you come across it?
See, when I was initially homeless, I felt completely isolated and alone. Mm. I think because of where I found myself feeling most safe, I would most evenings, if I didn't have somewhere to sleep, I'd walk as far out of the city as possible just to be away from people. So I'd walk to probably the south end of Cambridge or just outside the city where I knew it was very quiet and isolated, and it was unlikely after a certain time of night people would come across me and it would be unlikely that I'd be moved on. So it wasn't until I actually went to Winter Comfort that I saw sort of the community feel. Mm. There is a lot of people that I have met and I still see and still pass today that I met at Winter Comfort, and they will still come and say hello. They will still shake my hand. They will still wave. And it hurts because I'm so grateful for being back in a position where I have a roof over my head and I have a career again and a great income and everything's going well, but knowing that those people are still there and having to walk past them each day knowing that I've got somewhere to go home to, I think that is something that is very difficult to deal with. It's something that in the moment you don't think of, almost in like a selfish way. You're just so grateful that your own life is back on track. And I can almost understand how people can walk down the street and walk past someone homeless and they don't bat an eyelid because obviously they don't understand. They've not lived that lifestyle. They don't understand the circumstances. They make unfortunate presumptions about their lifestyles and how they've ended up in that situation, almost as if it's their own fault when fundamentally it isn't. So I do believe there is a community there, and it's unfortunate that it is a community, because that community only exists because there is not the correct infrastructure to help those people out of that situation. And I think that's why it's crucially important that stories like this do get heard, just so people are more aware and more willing to help, because there's this awful stigmatism that homelessness is strictly self-inflicted. Mm. And that quite simply is not the case.
And don't forget, it's a lifestyle choice.
Oh, gosh, yeah. We won't dwell on that.
So when people get to you, Melody, someone like John gets in touch, is there a set procedure, regardless of who he is and where he's come from, or who she is or where she's come from, and we'll come on to that in a minute, is there a set procedure that you would follow?
Anyone that comes to Winter Comfort will go through a sort of an assessment process. So when people arrive, they will sit down with someone that's a trained support worker and will really go through an assessment of their needs. Now, someone like John was able to really clearly articulate exactly what's going on, what's happened, where do I want to get to, how do I get there? People will present in all different kinds of ways. So some people may be very unwell and not able as easily to articulate what it is that they'll need, or they may be very fearful and lacking any trust and not really want to open up about the full extent of their circumstances. So it's really a process of building trust and building the relationships with the people that come for support until the point at which they feel able to open up and ask for the help that they really need to change their circumstances. And many people just don't know. Many people just feel stuck in a rut and absolutely can't see a way out of that. And so part of our work is really fundamentally underpinning everything is to help people to feel human again and to get a sense of who they are, to get a sense that we're not judging, we're not questioning what you've done in the past. We want to look to your future and to try and find out how you get to the point you need to be at. And it doesn't happen quickly. For some people like John, you know, he's a, as we've said repeatedly, he's fabulous and, you know, very resilient and, you know, great. He knows what he's doing. He's got opportunities that he'll go on to do great things. But for other people, they may not have that personal resilience. It's not something that we all have in us. So it's just the journey for some people may be very long over periods of years. And we see many people that will fall into homelessness repeatedly, and they'll go into accommodation and they'll build their lives back together, and then for whatever reason they may not be able to cope, and then they're back again. And that's a really sad thing for us to, you know, kind of wave goodbye to people that have had support for a long time with hopes for their better future, and then of course to see them back again. And but I think that one of the things that Winter Comfort will always stand by is that there is no such thing as a you always have a second chance. You'll always have a third chance, a fourth. No matter how many chances you need, Winter Comfort will always welcome you back to try and get you to where you want to be.
You just answered my question, which was going to be, is there ever a point at which you go, nah?
Not really. I mean, there have been very rare occasions if someone is so mentally unwell that they are presenting with dangerous behaviour that would be, you know, a risk to other members of staff or to other people accessing support. And there are times where we are simply not the most suitable support service for someone in that particular set of circumstances. But that's rare, I think. You know, we're a very welcoming organisation, and that is a very rare thing. So no, as long as people need us, we're there. And there are people that I saw today in the centre. You know, this chap's in accommodation and he was supported to help get his job with one of Winter Comfort support workers, and I think he's looking for a new position, and he's come back just to say, yeah, I'm doing okay, but I really could do with a bit of help with this job application. And of course that's great, because we're not just there for people that are rough sleeping. It's helping people to sustain tenancies after they've been homeless as well. So it's, you know, saying, great, you've done this, but if you find yourself at a point where you feel like you're teetering on the edge again, come straight back in. Don't ever lose your tenancy again. So and I know that you, John, have got some ongoing issues with different sort of benefits and things that you've sorted out yourself now, but you knew that the door was open. You knew that you could pick up the phone and say, oh, I'm having an awful time with this, can anyone just give me a hand? And yes, of course, that will always be the answer.
Now, how much can you do that you can do because you're trained and you've got the resources? And how much do you have to go, no, we need to bring in external help on this? And how much can you sort of point people in the right direction? How much can you sort of insist that they go in the right direction?
Well, I mean, we work very collaboratively with all of the different agencies in the city. There are lots of different homeless support charities, and we're part of someone called the Streets to Home Partnership, which is a collective, really with the purpose of all these independent charities best sharing practice and, you know, understanding we're all sorts supporting the same people. So we work across all of the sector like that, but we also do work really well and closely with the mental health team, CGL, Care Grow Live, which is a drug and alcohol support service. Alison will be able to speak more broadly about all of the different agencies that we work with, but we really do reach out to people. I think that's something, certainly since I've been there, the pandemic seemed to be a bit of a catalyst for change in that, and the way that everyone works so closely together. And you know, always within the centre there'll be people on a Zoom meeting or on a call with different agencies, partner agencies, all, you know, saying, have you seen so and so, and great, yeah, we've got concerns about this. And so it's really good that we can share information like this. A lot of the stuff we can do ourselves, but we will always bring in external support. So we work with fully trained counsellors to provide counselling services that we pay for with the money that we raise to support people that have got experience of homelessness. So we deliver those services at Winter Comfort, working with professionals to do the delivery of the services. And one of the things I think that works so well for us as an organisation is that, as John said, you do sense this kind of, yeah, I feel like I'm at home here. People that come here and, you know, to Winter Comfort over an extended period of time, very quickly open up and relax. And that's when they will really engage with the nurse that's coming in from the access surgery. Or, yeah, I think I need counselling, but I don't want to go anywhere. No, okay, come here, do it here. So it's really... it's a hub. You know, that's what we like to think of ourselves as, a hub for support.
Excellent, excellent. Now, you mentioned Alison a few times. Let's bring her in now. Alison Nolan, you're the Senior Women's Project Worker. Now, yes. I can imagine across the board, this is a very gender-neutral situation. Rough sleeping, homelessness is very gender-neutral. But I think it's fair to say that I wouldn't want to see women on the streets. They are, to my mind, more vulnerable. I may be completely wrong. How do you find the situation, and what services, how do you tailor things towards women as opposed to John here?
Well, it's funny because it is very gendered in how women experience homelessness, and it's, some of it's more obvious than others, sort of thing. I mean, physically women are weaker, mm-hmm. so if somebody wants to assault them, yeah. then they can do that quite easily, and women haven't physically got the defence to that. But also there's similarities all through. A huge number of the people we work with have been through trauma and have distress of some kind in their life. With the women, it's almost 100%. It's standard for our women to be traumatised. Many of them are now getting diagnosed with PTSD because of the abuse and trauma, the violence they've gone through. A lot of them are hidden. So, and before we started running the women's service, we were sort of like aware of 10 to 20 women who lived a street-based life or actually sleep in rough. We're currently working with 220.
Oh, for goodness sake.
And that isn't the end of it. That's just the ones that have found us. So we're very aware of making sure we're all about being welcoming, and that the women have control over what they do, they have choices, and we try to make it girly. We have pretty tablecloths and we have fairy lights and we do our nails quite a lot. but we make changes to make it a more of a woman's space when the girls come in. And while a lot of the yes, I have no home, I need a home type issues are the same, overcoming the trauma and abuse is a lot, you know, being friendly, being trustworthy and giving all the help you can and making the right referral is really important. Really enjoyable as well. They're lovely girls.
I was going to say, and you say there about, you know, the nails and the girly thing, but it's exactly what John is saying, isn't it, about how getting you back to being you.
Yeah, yeah. It's valuing them and seeing them as having worth. Any woman that goes through any kind of prolonged abuse reaches a point where they think they're not worthy. Mm. They're not worthy of help. They're not worth anything. So looking after themselves becomes just another chore. What's the point? I'm worth nothing. So it's trying to get back into that, you know, we often have donated clothes, either from staff or outside donations. And we'll have a catwalk, and we will be trying those clothes on. And we'll be laughing and advising and being feminine, because that's something that gets lost. Mm. And giving the women back their worth, because they have value. They're all amazingly strong women who survive in a hostile environment.
I was going to say, just to make that decision to leave often, to get to escape in that way.
Yeah. And it's, a lot of them end up in very abusive relationships, because if you're on the street, it's safer to have one person who's hitting you than to be available for any man who feels like abusing you on the street. So work on safe relationships, independence and recognising the skills they've got is really important. And as Melody said, we don't stop work. I always tell the girls, I'm here till you sack me, because life doesn't stop like that. A lot of problems come because the girls have burnt bridges with the family who don't understand the trauma they've gone through and will disown sometimes. So we become that network. We become the family that you can come back to and ask. I mean, I'm nearly 60 and I still will go and ask advice of my dad at times. I get the usual roll of the eyes, but some people haven't got that. So we can be there with the support and advice
And I mean, you're not a refuge in that way, are you? You're not a women's refuge. So what about the situation with women who perhaps had to leave children and perhaps need anonymity and you know, to be kept at a safer... Do you liaise with people on that and sort of keep it all under wraps?
Yeah, we can refer to Women's Aid and refugees, and we work regularly with Women's Aid, Rape Crisis, the Women's Resource Centre, you know, all organisations that are purely there for women. It's a lot of the time, it's difficult because if you suffer from abuse and you want to help to escape that partner, the councils won't house you where you are. They will only house you somewhere else.
Right.
The argument being that the person who's been abusing you will find you, it's not going to solve anything. Which makes sense, except if you have no one else in the country, you're going to be moving to a town at your lowest when you feel worthless, where you have depression, you've been abused, all of those issues, and you're going to be dumped in a hotel or a hostel, knowing no one, with nobody to help you. And it's so isolating that a lot of women don't want to do that. It's too scary. So trying to find accommodation and be safe can be really tricky. The refuges are amazing. But again, limited spaces, limited funding. So, I mean, we often will move sideways and refer to projects that aren't about domestic abuse, but they are supported and will protect the women. But we have to listen to what the women want themselves.
Yeah. Now, that's key about all of this, isn't it? It's doing what you want. And I guess in your situation, John. And you were saying, I mean, we were talking there about accommodation. You mentioned that you were spending this time in hotels. You weren't the only person, you were telling us before we started. You weren't the only person there. So it's not like you were the one guy who decided he was going to set himself up in a hotel for a few days.
Yeah, that's completely correct. I mean, where I was staying at the time, I actually met three other men that were in the exact same circumstances, where it was just sort of relationships that hadn't panned out. Maybe they were sort of a lover's tiff that had kind of escalated into something a little bit more long term. And I actually ended up befriending another gentleman called John that had been there for maybe 3 weeks at the time. And it was a very bizarre set of circumstances. He'd literally just overheard me talking to a member of staff and he decided to engage with me. And that's when I found out his story, which obviously completely resonated with myself because we were both in the exact same circumstances. But just to touch on something that Alison mentioned about finding accommodation. So one of the bigger problems that I ran into as well is the councils will try and pass you off onto different councils. So after I lost my job, because I was no longer deemed to have an immediate connection with the area, they tried to basically send me to a different location because in their mind, if I didn't have a job and I wasn't connected to that council, they didn't want to give me any support. So then they would refer me to a different council that I might have some form of connection to. Almost in essence, them saying, well, where are you from originally? Let's send you back there because it's that jurisdiction's problem, not ours.
That is amazing, isn't it? It comes back to this whole thing about we'll pick you up when you get that low. When you get low enough, we'll catch you then. Then you become our problem. My goodness me! It's Christmas. Let's turn the vibe up here a little bit, shall we? Because things have worked out. You're sat here in the studio. You're smiling. Your hair's done. You're in clean black. You're looking good. How did that recovery happen? How did you get your life back on track?
So, yeah, unfortunately, obviously, after losing the job and losing the accommodation, I was basically stuck in this really unfortunate house of cards where I was waiting for the first domino to fall. Yeah. Obviously, you can't be in full-time employment without somewhere to live, and you can't have somewhere to live without being in full-time employment. It was literally through the support of Winter Comfort in particular that gave me somewhere to wash my clothes and somewhere to refresh and sort of feel humanized again, which gave me the confidence to basically attend interviews. And although I couldn't finance getting to those interviews, I would walk for miles to get there. And eventually I went to an interview. I was very fortunate that they'd offered me the job role. I then took that contract, like sort of the primary offer, took that then back to the council, and then the council then agreed that they would offer me the loan again. And it was almost as if, I can't even explain it, one day I had absolutely nothing, and then 2 days later it was like my life was almost back on track. Unfortunately, I did have to wait quite a while for all of that to be processed, and obviously they did try and sort of expedite things as quickly as they could. But when you're sleeping rough, one day seems like an eternity.
Yeah.
And I think the biggest fear, and like I said to Melody when we spoke, my biggest fear was 5 o'clock. During the week, 5 o'clock was my biggest fear, because as soon as 5 p.m. hit, I knew there was no one there to talk to anymore. Mm. I couldn't call anyone from Citizens Advice. I couldn't go anywhere for support. Everywhere was closed. And then my biggest fear was the weekends. Once the weekend rolls around, they're all closed. That support is no longer there. And the only place that I could go to on a Saturday and Sunday was, of course, Winter Comfort. And I think that's, well, ironically, where I found so much comfort, because it was somewhere I could return to. I think once all of that was in place, I was just waiting somewhat patiently. I think knowing that I had something to look forward to for the first time, I think that was the thing that kind of like reinvigorated me and made me feel much more like myself. But then, almost as a sick contrast to that, once I did move in, I felt kind of lost. I felt incredibly lost. I was so accustomed to being outdoors that I'd find myself staring out of the window, and I'd want to be outdoors again. I think it was almost as if I was so happy and sheltered, but I felt kind of undeserving of it. And I felt suffocated just being in like this small room. And I think part of me just wanted to go outside and just let reality sink in. It was almost as if walking around the city helped me almost appreciate what I had. And I think what I have now, I appreciate more than I've ever appreciated things in my life. And it's also given me a huge insight, because as much as it pains me to say it, I think some of the stereotypes that are attributed to the people that are sleeping rough on the streets, I think, looking back on my life, I am one of those people that's guilty for making those assumptions. And I think only being on the receiving end of sort of ill circumstances that led to me being in that situation, I think that's what's really opened my eyes and made me realise that it's not what people think. Anyone can be homeless, and all it takes is one split-second decision or someone to lose their job, especially in today's economy. And before you know it, we're all just as vulnerable as each other. And I think until people realise that and strengthen the infrastructure to help people get the support that they need, obviously through the likes of Melody at Winter Comfort and Alison, I don't think that the situation's going to change. It's only going to worsen as the economy crumbles further and further.
And how are you seeing this, Melody? From your point of view, John's story echoed, or is his thoughts there echoed? Is this right? Is it just going to get worse? We're not going to cure this problem anytime soon.
Well, it's a difficult one, isn't it? I think over the past 3 years, demand has just risen and risen and risen. Mm. And I recently compared the number of people we're supporting with 2 years ago. And we're seeing 65% more people now. This year, by the end of the financial year, if we continue as we expect to at the same rate of increasing in demand, we'll be supporting nearly 800 people, which is a lot of people, just in our relatively small city.
I was going to say, that's just Cambridge and maybe the cities, maybe the villages around.
Not even really. I mean, it really is the centre. I mean, it really is the city, isn't it, Alison? Really. Obviously, people will come in from surrounding outlying villages for support, but it's... there need to be systemic changes. Winter Comfort, no charity can solve the problem of homelessness. All we can do is be there to empower people to rebuild their lives, but there need to be fundamental changes.
But going back a little while, as you say, pre-pandemic, It Takes a City came along. Yeah. And I was very inspired by that, the idea that all the organisations who deal with the system, the city council as well, the university, and with businesses that wanted to engage, all got together and went, how can we work this out? Where are the problems here? Where do people come into the system and then drop out, and then we find that they're come back in over here again. It did seem that we were ahead, and then along came the pandemic, and that seemed as well to be, right, we're going to take a different approach to how we look after the Rusty. We get them in one place, we can feed them, we can bring in the key support all to one place. It does seem like there's been some real changes over the past few years here in Cambridge, but the problem's still getting worse.
Well, the Everyone In initiative, which is what we're speaking about when we talk about what happened in the pandemic, was government funded. It needs money behind it to provide accommodation for everyone. The model of getting people into accommodation and then providing sustained support to keep them there makes sense. I would say it makes sense. Yeah. Housing First is the model that is now still something that is available in Cambridge for people who really have very complex needs and just simply wouldn't be able to cope within a different setting. It's a good model, but it's not cheap. It needs investment. We know that. It's not a quick fix. Giving someone a key to a door without any surrounding support is pointless. It's not the lack of a home for most people that's their overarching problem. I would say maybe. I mean, that's probably not most people, but a significant number of people that we see at Winter Comfort cannot sustain accommodation without significant support around them. And it's just lacking elsewhere. It's just not available elsewhere.
Alison?
Yeah, I mean, there are some amazing agencies and people working in Cambridge with the homeless, but quite often they're bounded. I mean, we work with NHS staff, with mental health provision and things like that, and they're amazing, absolutely amazing, but they're constricted by what they're allowed to provide. I mean, and that's one of the reasons I've never left Winter Comfort, is that we'll keep going, we'll keep going, we will keep helping. We're not a three strikes and you're out, or you've missed an appointment, so you've got to go through the whole referral process again, which is a massive barrier. But as Melody said, that sustained support is expensive.
That's why you need how much a year, Melody?
Well, Winter Comfort, we need to raise our turnover is about 1.2 million, a small percentage of that is statutory funding. So it's under 15% is from statutory sources, because we're an independent charity and we don't provide accommodation. So if there's a charity that has accommodation provision, like hostels, they will be partly funded, well, to a fairly significant level, by housing benefits of the people that live there. But of course, Winter Comfort doesn't have that element of accommodation. Therefore, it has to be self-generated income, which is a challenge.
That's where you come in. Well, it's amazing work you do, and it's obviously been proven through by John's experience here. I mean, John, effectively, you've dropped out of the system and made it back in within a calendar year, which is good going, I would guess. That's great.
Yeah.
I mean, my worry is that there, especially in Cambridge, where it's the most unequal city in the country, or second most, depending on whose stats you follow, there are an awful lot of people sitting out there right now with the company car on the drive and the mortgage, and considering what decorations are in the extension and all this sort of stuff, who are actually blissfully unaware of what might just be round the corner. What words of advice, what words of wisdom would you have for them, John, about avoiding what happened to you?
I think, in retrospect, now I've sort of re-solidified myself within Cambridge, and I've been very grateful for all of the support from Winter Comfort and the people around me. I think the best advice that I can give people to avoid being in that circumstances is just one, obviously, rainy day fund. Always have a rainy day fund, because you never know what bills are suddenly going to hit you. You don't know what's around the corner. I mean, like you mentioned, company car, etc. But you never know when the boiler's going to break.
No.
And you don't know whether you're going to be without heating during the winter. And you don't know. You just don't know. I mean, I think so many people are seemingly self-assured in the fact that they've got everything that they need. And I think people don't plan very well for the future and don't give themselves the actual provisions that they need for survivability. I think people are somewhat so focused on things that are maybe arbitrary, like the things that are unimportant, not the necessities. And I think maybe don't go and spend all of that money on an iPhone, and don't go and spend all of that money on upgrading a car that you don't particularly need. Keep that money, because you never know when you're going to need it most.
Indeed, indeed. I mean, from your point of view, it's obviously a traumatic experience, probably doesn't even begin to describe it. But has it made you a better person?
I think it's definitely changed my outlook on life. I can't refute that at all. I mean, like I said, I was blinded to the homeless culture of the city or just in the UK in general. I didn't realise how severe some of the circumstances were and also just how terribly poor the support is. Mm. So I do think that's given me so much more insight, and I do believe that's made me a better person because it's made me definitely more empathetic towards people. It's also made me a better friend because, like I said, I was too stubborn and self-proud to reach out to my friends, but it's given me more self-assurance knowing that my friends are there for me when I need them most and know that they want to support me. And that's advice that I'd always give to other people as well, is that always reach out to your friends. Don't keep secrets from them. Don't hide things from them, because as much as you think that you're saving them hurt and worry from not telling them just how severe your circumstances are, all you're doing is prolonging that pain, because once they know and feel almost as if they've let you down by not being supportive, I think that's just as bad. So I think, yeah, all around it has made me a better person. It's made me more inquisitive to ask about other people's life stories. I mean, you mentioned that how sometimes people walk around almost blissfully unaware to people that are homeless around them. I think a lot of people would have passed me in the street and never suspected that I was homeless. Mm. I've been in certain places where people have had conversations with me and they've just been completely unable to acknowledge like the circumstances that I'm in. The only thing that they'd kind of maybe question is why I'm walking around with a huge sort of B&M bag that was full of all of my belongings, all of my clothes, everything that I owned that I was carrying from place to place. I think other than that, nobody would ever have questioned it. I think people would engage in conversation with me and they'd hear how I express myself and how basically I'd hold a conversation, and never in a million years would they actually stop and think, hang on a second, there's something not quite right here. Why is he carrying all of his clothes in a bag?
Yeah.
Like, why does he look so exhausted? Why does he seem like he could literally like fall asleep mid-sentence any moment? So I do think, yeah, people's eyes do need to be opened, but I do believe fundamentally all around that, yeah, the as much as it was a painful experience and the 77 days that I spent living rough and sleeping on the streets, as much as I'd never want to relive them, I do believe it has fundamentally made me a better person.
And you must be looking forward to the future. You must be looking you must appreciate so much of the things that you once perhaps took for granted.
Yeah, of course. I'm definitely more appreciative. I think there is a strange part of me now that is still somewhat scared and concerned that I'll end up back there. And I think I'm trying so hard to mitigate for that. I haven't entirely let my guard down just yet. So as much as I'm looking forward to the future and what it might hold, I think I'm very reluctant to spend money on anything.
But that's no bad thing.
Of course.
I don't think that's a bad thing at all. Keep your eye to the future, but have one eye on what could go wrong. And I think that to be mindful of that is got to be a great thing to have in your life.
Yeah, it's great for, well, mindfulness is always of huge benefit, whether it's for mental health or whether it's just of, obviously, your own independence and taking care of yourself. But I think, in a bizarre sense, it's almost been a little bit detrimental in the sense, it's almost like a paranoia now.
Right.
I think it's almost as if every time I have to spend money on something, I'm like, maybe I shouldn't spend that. Or it's simple things. And I mean, because I became so accustomed to traversing across such a ridiculous length of distance on foot, because I'd be walking maybe 30 miles a day.
Wow.
So now when one of my friends would suggest, we can just get a taxi, it's only around the corner, I'm like, absolutely not. We will be walking. But then it'll be a silly distance. It'll be like 2.5 miles in the rain. I was like, yeah, we can walk that. It's fine. So yeah, I think it has changed my outlook on life, and I am looking forward to the future. And honestly, I'm just very grateful to Melody and the rest of Winter Comfort, because without their support, it wouldn't be a future I'd be able to look forward to.
Wow. And Alison, let's turn our attention just to you, because we're talking there about what words of advice. What words would you give to young women, housewives, women of any age who might be sitting at the moment thinking, hang on a minute, this could be me?
ask for help, reach out. You know, there's so many of us working in services that want to help, and you deserve help, so you should ask for it. Nobody should have to suffer in silence, and if the help's there, ask for it.
Excellent. And Melody, from Winter Comfort's point of view, you know, what message would you send out to people? Come and knock on the door?
Absolutely do that. You know, we're there. We're there for you. And if we're not the right person to help you, we will not just tell you to go away. We will tell you, right, this is who you can talk to. Let's introduce you to these people. As Alison said, ask for help. Come and talk to Winter Comfort. On our website, there's actually a little bit at the top of the toolbar that says Get Support. And you can just click on that, sends an email to our team, and then we'll get in touch with you. So you don't have to physically come to the building. Just give us a call, drop us a line. We will get back in touch with you. We will be able to help you in some way.
Fantastic. Well, there we are. It's been a fascinating story. The reason I wanted everyone to hear it is because it's not your average Joe story. John, it's been an absolute pleasure to meet you. Thank you for sharing your story with us. Brave step to do. And I think to hear your story firsthand like that, it just makes us all realise that we're, you know, most of us, thankfully, very fortunate in the position we're in. And it's been very good of you to say. To Alison, for all those years that you've been working with those people, thank you on their behalf, because countless people have been helped by you. And you're planning on keeping up the good work, I hope.
Oh, yeah. No, I love it. I mean, that was the learning curve for me when I started the job. I had, you know, stereotyped ideas of what it would be like, and it's nothing like that. We're like a coffee shop where you just chat with very interesting, nice strangers.
Yeah, same.
It's lovely.
Tough old job then, yeah.
I know. I drink coffee all day and talk to amazing women. I love it.
And that, I think, is the one thing, isn't it? Is that everyone said, you know, John has said it as well, that you come along, you're treated like a human being. You go down, you have a cup of coffee. Yes, you've got your problems, but your problems we can talk about and sort out. It's you get down there and you talk about people who talk to people who genuinely care. Mm. And probably know the right people to deal with the situation. And Melody, well, for your point of view, there's Winter Comfort doing all this stuff. It's good stuff, isn't it?
It's
must be a great job to have.
It is a great job, and I love the charity deeply, and the people that we support and the team, really great people, and it's a privilege to be part of that journey.
Well, thank you very much indeed to Melody Brooker, Fundraising and Communications Manager for Winter Comfort, to Alison Nolan, Senior Women's Project Worker at Winter Comfort, but more importantly to you, John, and we wish you absolutely every best wish for the future, and may you all have a lovely 2024. Thank you.
Here it all comes now. Christmas is coming, all frosty and fresh. Time to get wrapped up and warm with good friends. Sing along a buble, hot drinks by the tree. Let's get together and share what we need. Winter Comfort, it's got our side. Winter Comfort, nobody should fall. Winter Comfort, the one for all. Winter Comfort, nobody should fall. Tinsel one far in the grave. Mince pies and mulled wine, and let's have a bowl. Let's have a good one. There's room. There's room for us. Is here all tinsel and lights. Presents are unwrapped, let games and delight. Get ready in the kitchen, more drinks by the sink. Let's get together and laugh and let's eat. Winter comfort, it's cold outside. Winter comfort, nobody should fall. Winter comfort, the one of the world. Winter comfort, nobody should fall. Here it is, the anticipation's past.